This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Grandma Was Right After All, Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days, by John Rosemond, narrated by Jonathan Yen. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Exodus chapter 20, verse 12. When the foundations are being destroyed, what can the righteous do? Psalm chapter 11, verse 3, New International Version. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord, and depart from evil. It will be health to your flesh, and strength to your bones. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 through 8. Understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty, for people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having the appearance of godliness but denying its power. Avoid such people. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, English Standard Version. Introduction. The vernacular or colloquial speech of a culture has meaning beyond the meanings of the words themselves. There is meaning, the accepted or dictionary definition of a word, and then there is what is termed meta-meaning, what the words reflect concerning the culture, among other things. Take, for example, the recently popular phrase, get a life. The words themselves can mean a variety of things, depending on context. The phrase can mean that the person it's spoken to is obsessing about something trivial. Sometimes, get a life is used to end a contentious discussion when the speaker doesn't know what else to say. Whatever the immediate intent or meaning, however, get a life is always, without exception, a sarcastic form of disrespect. It's a dismissal or belittling of another person's point of view, and its recent ubiquity is a reflection of the general deterioration of respect that has taken place in America since the 1960s. Get a life is the sort of thing people begin saying to one another when self-centeredness trumps all other social considerations. In other words, popular vernacular reflects the zeitgeist, the culture's mindset or collective worldview. Likewise, the loss of certain vernacular reflects the loss of a certain consensual point of view. When I was growing up, the sayings of Ben Franklin, as recorded in his Poor Richard's Almanac, were still in common usage. Everyone my age, when we were kids, was told, "A penny saved is a penny earned." We also heard, "Waste not, want not," another of Franklin's sayings. With the nod to the extremely rare exception, kids don't hear either of these aphorisms anymore. The explanation for their effective disappearance is not that they're old-fashioned. Consider that they were still in common use in the 1950s, when they were already 200 years old. Very old-fashioned indeed. Ben Franklin's sayings have fallen out of fashion because frugality is no longer a commonly held American virtue. We live in a spendthrift, wasteful age. Consumerism rules the America of today. In fact, a frugal person today is regarded as a cheapskate, a tightwad. As with sayings like, "a penny saved is a penny earned," the entire parenting vernacular of the pre-1960s has virtually disappeared and been replaced by nothing. Well, that's not exactly true. The vernacular of post-1960s American parenting consists of phrases like, "good job," and That's terrific. And give me five. And you're the best. And when you grow up, you can do anything you want to do. This is very new and novel parenting language, for sure. My parents occasionally told me I'd done a good job, but for every good job, they told me at least three times that I could have done a better job. And when they did tell me I'd done a good job, it didn't carry an exclamation point. It was matter-of-fact, straightforward, and because it was doled out conservatively, I knew I'd really, truly done a good job. And make no mistake, my parents were typical of their generation. Overwhelmingly, my peers tell me their parents were interchangeable with mine. I knew my parents loved me, but they apparently didn't think that being stingy with praise would damage my psyche. And it didn't. Neither did being told that I was acting too big for my britches, which I heard nearly every time I acted too big for my britches. Taking that example, it is very rare for children today to hear they are acting too big for their britches. Instead, their parents tell them, with great effusion, that they have done a great job, followed by one or more exclamation points, at least once a day. Less than that will starve their psyches of warm fuzzies, which are necessary to the proper formation of high self-esteem. Some kids are told they've done a great job, or words to that effect, at least five times a day. It doesn't matter how well they do something. It's a great job! Exclamation point. Give me five! Chest bump! You're the man! The near extinction of "you're acting too big for your britches" and the rise of the indiscriminate "great job" reflect the fact that since the 1950s we have lost one parenting point of view and replaced it with one that is quite the opposite. In the 1950s, modesty was a virtue that parents tried to instill in their kids. Therefore, when children were acting immodestly, they were told they needed to resize themselves to their britches. Today, high self-esteem is the ideal, the brass ring of la dolce vita. Parents in the 1950s and before attempted to rein in their children's natural inclination toward high opinions of themselves. Today's parents, by and large, make no such attempt. They want their children to have high opinions of themselves. Supposedly, a high opinion of oneself results in high achievement and good mental health, although the research on both finds exactly the opposite. The general parenting point of view has changed, and radically so. The point of view that told kids they were busting out of their britches is in history's dustbin, replaced by a point of view that tells kids the lie that everything they do and say is amazing, incredible, awesome, unparalleled in the history of mankind, and that they can do anything they want to do when they grow up. I am one of those throwbacks who happens to think that the old point of view is more functional and more in children's best interests. The objective evidence is on my side. Kids of the 1950s were a lot more emotionally sturdy than today's kids. That's borne out by reliable statistics. We came to first grade not knowing our ABCs. We were not allowed to get out of our seats when we had finished our classwork, in overcrowded, underfunded classrooms, and had mothers who would not give us much help, if any, with our homework. Worst of all, we could actually fail tests and even entire school years. And yet, despite these liabilities, we outperformed today's kids at every single grade level. We left home much earlier than today's kids are leaving home, and when we left successfully. I will note here that there are, of course, exceptions to everything I say about then and now, but my generalities reflect verifiable norms. Our physiologies were no different from those of today's kids, nor were we smarter. We were simply raised better. At this point, you can snort if you wish. In these progressive times, it is deemed incorrect to say that the past was better than the present in any regard. That's called Golden Age thinking, an attribute, supposedly, of old fogies who just can't accept that times have changed, and changed for the better. Such people, including yours truly, apparently, have a mental disorder that causes them to believe the ridiculous idea that the past, or significant aspects of it, was an improvement over the present. In response to charges of that sort of retro-utopian thinking, let me ask you a couple of questions. First, is it better to be frugal or a spendthrift, to A, buy only what one needs and can afford, or B, dig a deeper and deeper debt hole with every passing day? Second, is it more socially gracious to A, be modest about one's accomplishments, or B, trumpet them from the proverbial rooftop? You answered A to both questions, did you not? My point is that it is accurate to say that certain aspects, just certain aspects, of the past were, in fact, better than their contemporary counterparts. And so it is with my generation. We were raised better by Tom Brokaw's greatest generation, the generation that overcame every adversity life could throw at them. It's to their credit, certainly not ours, that we turned out so well. Again, speaking generally, but accurately. It is, however, our fault that we boomers did not realize the gift we'd been given and pass it along to our kids. The pundits convinced us that the parenting baby needed tossing out with the bathwater, that the wheat needed burning with the chaff, that new ideas were better than old ideas, and that the past was a rotten apple and the future a bowl of cherries. And so, in the late 1960s, we came to a fork in the parenting road, to switch metaphors, upon which we followed poet Robert Frost's well-known example and took the road never traveled. And, as Frost observed, that ill-conceived decision sure has made all the difference. In general, today's parents are experiencing more problems with their kids than their great-grandparents could have imagined parents ever experiencing. Their kids talk back to them, ignore them, blatantly disobey them, call them names, and even hit and kick when the parents do not perform satisfactorily. Most of all, their children don't pay attention to them. They don't take them seriously. Today's parents think these problems can be solved by using correct discipline methods, or correct medications. They do not realize that these problems are the inevitable consequences of a faulty point of view, that until their parenting point of view changes for the better, until they begin thinking like parents of the 1950s, in other words, no clever discipline method they use is going to work for long, if it works at all. So, when I'm working with parents who are experiencing the inevitable consequences of treating children as if they are the most important people, not just in the family, but whoever walked the earth, my first approach is to help them change their point of view, to help them begin thinking like their grandparents and great-grandparents. To accomplish that, I often train them in the use of the old parenting vernacular. You're acting too big for your britches. You made this bed, so you're going to lie in it. I knew if I gave you a long rope, you'd hang yourself. Because I said so. And so on. The results are often nothing short of amazing. Parents tell me, for example, that within days of first receiving healthy doses of the old parenting language, their kids begin listening, obeying, and acting respectfully. Sometimes this sudden sea change occurs with kids as old as 8 or 10 who have never before listened to, obeyed, or respected their parents. After years of hearing these sorts of testimonials, I decided to preserve the old parenting language in a book. My purpose is to help you appreciate and grasp the old parenting point of view, and in so doing, to change your and your children's lives for the better. First, you need to learn the language. The more you talk it, the more you will begin to walk it. Who is Grandma, anyway? The grandma of the title and the numerous references in this book is the typical mother of the pre-psychological parenting age, which officially began in 1965 with the publication of psychologist Haim Gnat's groundbreaking bestseller, Between Parent and Child. As I have explained in other books, most notably Parent Babble, How Parents Can Recover from 50 Years of Bad Expert Advice, Gnat introduced American parents to a brand spanking new set of understandings concerning children and their proper upbringing, understandings based primarily on humanistic psychological theory. It is important to note that these theories, and therefore Gnat's derivative ideas, had never been verified with good research. Because of his impressive credentials, a Ph.D. psychologist who practiced in the intellectual mecca of Manhattan, parents assumed Gnat knew what he was talking about. In fact, he did not. Like Freud and many other psychologists before and since, Gnat pulled his ideas out of a hat, a very shiny top hat, to be sure, but a hat nonetheless. The amazing success of Between Parent and Child set in motion a cascade of parenting books written by psychologists and other mental health professionals, all of which reflected and reinforced the new psychological parenting paradigm. This new paradigm was not Grandma's paradigm, for sure. It was, in fact, as opposite from Grandma's point of view as opposite can be. Most importantly, Grandma's point of view was congruent with a biblical understanding of child and parental responsibilities. That is not to say that every grandma was Bible-believing, but even those pre-1960s grandmas who were unfamiliar with the Bible's teachings concerning children were rearing their children, however unwittingly, according to those teachings. For example, Grandma believed that humility was a virtue. The new psychological paradigm held, and still holds, that high self-esteem is a desirable attribute. Grandma believed spankings had their proper place in the raising of a child. Gnat echoed the rising sentiment of the psychological community when he said that spankings were abusive. There was no agreement whatsoever between Grandma's parenting point of view and methods and the emerging psychological approach. The grandma in this book is a mother raising children before 1960. She is, therefore, of my mother's or grandmother's generation. Today, she probably would be a great or even great-great grandmother, but the title Parenting According to Great-Grandma seemed cumbersome, so for the sake of convenience and clarity, Grandma it became. As the listener will soon discover, Grandma had her feet on solid ground when it came to children. Her eyes were clear, her approach was practical, and perhaps above all else, she was not one to mince words with her kids. Her parenting vernacular, represented by the aphorisms herein, which are not all-inclusive, but only the ones she used most often, was, as she would surely have described it, short and sweet. When people think about historic preservation, they are thinking in terms of buildings, art, books, clothing, and other tangible artifacts of earlier eras. But some of the language of those eras is worth preserving as well. I hope you agree and will do your part. The Bible tells me so. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Exodus chapter 20, verse 12. I happen to think that the significance of this scripture verse, also known as the Fifth Commandment, is often underplayed. The Apostle Paul tells us it is the only commandment that comes with a promise. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 2. One meaning of which is that through the successful passing of family traditions, which in some cases may also be cultural traditions, from generation to generation, the institution of family is preserved, and therefore culture is strengthened. One way of honoring one's mother and father is by embracing and preserving the values that were important to them, by passing them on to one's children. When those traditions and associated values are no longer passed along, when parents and ancestors are no longer honored in this fashion, children become prey to relativism, family ties weaken, and culture begins to disintegrate. This is precisely what happened in the 1960s, as America became a postmodern, progressive society. The baby boomer generation, taking their cues from the Pied Pipers of postmodernity, embraced one new, untested idea after another. These new ideas were intentionally antagonistic to the ideas and values that informed previous American generations. In fact, the relativists demonized those ideas and values and told us that we could prevent ourselves from repeating the sins of the past only by jettisoning all the old baggage and replacing it with a brand new utopian post-Christian vision, one that informed every facet of our daily lives. Replacing the old with the new required that children be raised according to the new point of view, that they be taught the new values from day one. And so, a millennia-old biblical point of view of child and parental responsibilities was replaced with a point of view informed by psychological theory, a mindset and approach I call postmodern psychological parenting. The consequence of trashing the traditional paradigm has been calamitous for children, parents, marriages, extended families, schools, communities, and culture. For the sake of all concerned, a parenting renewal is desperately needed. The re-strengthening of America begins by restoring traditional family values, a re-honoring of our foremothers and forefathers. Thus, the book you hold in your hands. To ponder and discuss. What are some specific ways in which you have allowed yourself to be caught up in postmodern psychological parenting? Are you raising your children in a fashion that is far removed from the manner in which your parents raised you and your grandparents raised them? If so, what do you think would be different about your children's behavior and attitudes if you had honored your father and your mother and followed their example when it came to your own kids? Were you easier to discipline than your kids are? Why? What is it that your parents did that made their parenting experience so much less fraught with stress? 1. Because I said so. It's safe to say that the parenting aphorism most associated with the good old days, when children respected adults and adults did not try to be liked by children, is, "Because I said so." Sometimes those four words ended with an exclamation point. Sometimes they ended with an added, "That's why," and sometimes they ended with both. I heard those four words fairly often when I was a child. So did every other child who grew up in the 1950s. At least, I've yet to meet someone my age who claims to have had parents who did not say these words, although I'm reasonably certain a few someones of the sort do exist. The exchange between parent and child might have gone something like this. Child: "May I have a bowl of ice cream?" Mother: "No, you may not." "Why not?" "Because I said so, that's why not." "But why?" "Goat's butt." "What does that mean?" "It means you're not having ice cream." Or the exchange might have involved something a parent told a child to do, as in the following example. Mother: "It's time for you to pick up your toys and put them away." Child: "But why?" "Because I said so." "Ugh, that's not a reason." "Well, it's the only reason you're getting, unless you want me to give your backside a reason." It is important to note that in both of these examples, the child demands to know the reason behind his mother's decision or instruction precisely because she does not give a reason. She does not explain herself. In the first example, the mother does not say, "No, honey, I'm so sorry, but you can't have ice cream right now because it's too close to dinner." In the second example, the mother does not say, "Sweetie pie, I need to run the vacuum cleaner in here, so I need you to pick up your toys and put them away." The very absence of a reason forces the child to demand. It is not, after all, a polite request, a reason to demand to know why or why not. In other words, for a parent to say, "Because I said so," requires that the parent not explain his or her decisions and instructions. Unlike parents back in the golden age of child rearing, it was not called parenting back then, today's parents explain themselves. They give their children reasons for the decisions they make and the instructions they convey. And because they explain themselves, they end up having arguments with their children. In the previous ice cream example, had the mother given a reason for her decision, if she had told her child that he could not have ice cream because dinner was imminent, her child would very likely have come back with, "No, it's not. I'll still eat my dinner. I promise." The mother then would have engaged the child in debate, trying to get the child to agree with her that he should not have ice cream when dinner is right around the proverbial corner. This mother's fantasy child eventually says, "You know, Mom, you're absolutely right. When you explain it like that, I can't help but agree. I mean, any intelligent person would have to agree, and you have that sticker on the back window of your minivan that says I'm in the honors program at school. So, yes, because you've made a rational appeal to my outstanding intelligence, I agree that it's not a good idea for me to have ice cream right now. Mom, I love you for many reasons, not the least of which is that you take such care to make sure I eat a balanced diet. Thank you, Mom." And had the second mother told her child that she wanted him to pick up his toys so she could vacuum, he would very likely have come back with something like, "I'm playing. Why do you have to vacuum now? Why can't you wait?" The mother would then attempt to get the child to agree that vacuuming takes precedence over playing, and that due to her many other responsibilities, this is the best time for her to vacuum, and therefore he should happily pick up his toys and put them away. That mother's fantasy child says, "Say no more, Mom. You've convinced me. I now realize that adult responsibilities are more important than a child's play. That realization is something I will cherish forever, Mom, as I cherish you. And you can believe I am going to do all I can to pass that lesson to my kids. Thank you, Mom." If the fantasy responses from these two fantasy children sound fantastic to the point of absurdity, it's because they are. No child anywhere or in any historical time has ever said anything along those lines to a parent. Granted, some children, as adults, come back to their parents and thank them for raising them so well. Both of my kids did that in their early 20s. But it took them becoming adults to understand and appreciate an adult point of view. Reasons, schmeasons. Today's parents believe that children deserve reasons. That is, after all, what the parenting experts have been telling parents since the 1960s. And so, today's parents explain themselves to their children. They give reasons. And so, their children argue. It's a fundamental cause and effect relationship. Explanations cause arguments. My point is that arguments between parent and child occur not because children have some argumentative gene or argumentative biochemical in their bodies, or because the part of the brain that governs respectful obedience is yet underdeveloped, but simply because parents give reasons and explanations. Those reasons and explanations stimulate pushback in the form of children telling parents that their reasons and explanations don't wash, that they aren't good enough. At that point, parents begin defending their reasons and explanations. Thus, arguments between parents and children abound. To summarize, in the absence of reasons and explanations, children have nothing to push back against. Thus, no arguments between parents and children. Simple, isn't it? A woman once told me she had a pronounced negative reaction to the thought of saying, "Because I said so," because her parents had often screamed those four words at her with an implied threat of soon-to-come violence. I had to agree that her parents had misused the because-I-said-so privilege. But her parents' mistake does not mean those four words are invalid. It should go without saying that because-I-said-so should not be screamed at a child or said in a threatening tone of voice. But then that applies to anything parents say. In other words, simply because some parents wrap those four words in a rigid, unreasonable, threatening attitude, they are not, in and of themselves, rigid, unreasonable, and threatening. My thesaurus gives the following synonyms for reasonable: sensible, rational, logical, and practical. And indeed, because I said so is all of that. First, it is the truth. The parent has made a decision. The parent has conveyed the decision. You cannot, I will not, or you will, to the child. Therefore, at the most basic of levels, because I said so is simply a statement of fact. Second, because I said so stops the potential for argument dead in its deadly tracks. As I said, when a parent refuses to explain, the child has nothing with which to manufacture an argument. The child's inclination to argue hits a stone wall. This is good, because when parents and children argue, no one profits. Third, because I said so reflects a ubiquitous social reality. To wit, people in positions of authority are not required to explain themselves to the people over whom they have authority. This applies to military officers, teachers, college professors, workplace managers, and business owners. Children who enter adulthood already having accepted that social reality, having become accustomed to it, courtesy of their parents, hold a distinct advantage over the children who enter adulthood believing, again courtesy of their parents, that they deserve reasons and explanations whenever they are given an instruction or are informed of a rule or a boundary. It is a reality that even in a democratic society, authority figures frequently make arbitrary decisions. A boss decides things are going to be done this way rather than that way, that the line is going to be drawn in one place rather than another, that the standard will be based on this measure as opposed to that one, and so on. Why? Because the boss says so, that's why. That is a boss's prerogative. And that's that, until the boss changes his or her mind or a new boss comes along. A prime example of what I'm saying just occurred to me, because I happen to be writing this chapter on April 15th, Tax Day. On this date, I pay to the government a certain percentage of my income. I do not determine said percentage. The government does. Furthermore, I do not pay income tax because I think the United States government deserves the money. In fact, the government has consistently failed to demonstrate good stewardship of my hard-earned money. In my estimation, and the estimation of many, the United States government is fiscally irresponsible. If a business was run the way our elected representatives run the country, the business would go belly up in less than 6 months. I do not want to pay what the Internal Revenue Service says I owe. No government official has ever given me a good reason why I should pay what I pay. Yet, I pay it nonetheless. Why? Because they say so. Period. End of story. Likewise, about 4 of every 5 parental decisions are founded on nothing more substantial than arbitrary personal predilection. The Wilsons do not allow their kids to have non-organic food. The Smiths do. Both sets of kids are healthy, well-behaved, and do well in school. Therefore, the Wilsons cannot defend their prohibition by pointing to some better outcome. Nonetheless, it is legitimate for them to deny their children food that is not certified organic. And when their children ask why they are denied foods the Smith kids enjoy, the most honest answer Mr. and Mrs. Wilson can give is, "Because we say so." Not only do today's parents feel obliged to explain themselves to their children, they also seem to believe that their explanations must satisfy and pacify the children in question. Consequently, those explanations take on a persuasive, pleading, even apologetic character. Implicit in this is the absolutely absurd idea that parents don't have a right to enforce a decision unless A, it can be supported by reasons other than personal preference, B, the children understand those reasons, and C, the children agree with them. This perspective causes lots of unnecessary pain for both parents and kids. Now, hear me clearly. I'm not saying that parents should never give reasons to children. I'm saying that parents should make no attempt to reason with children, and there is a big difference between the two. Reasoning is the futile attempt to persuade your children that your point of view is valid. Let's face it, your children will understand your point of view when they themselves are parents, and no sooner. If you want to explain yourself, then by all means do so. But don't expect your children to agree. When they don't, simply say, "I'm not asking you to agree. If I were you, I wouldn't agree with me either. You have my permission to disagree, but you don't have my permission to disobey." In other words, children do what they are told, not because their parents succeed at providing an explanation that smooths their ruffled feathers, but simply because they've been told. So even in the act of giving reasons, the bottom line is still, "Because I said so. The Bible tells me so." Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Colossians chapter 3, verse 20, New International Version. One Sunday, when Willie and I were visiting a church in the mountains of North Carolina, the pastor happened to be preaching on parenting. It quickly became obvious that he had been greatly influenced by psychological theory because his sermon could have been taken right out of my college child development textbook. He was talking about how important it is for parents to help their kids develop high self-esteem and how children need lots of attention and praise. Toward the end of his sermon, he said, "I don't think it's right for a parent to say, 'Because I said so.'" Willie and I looked at each other with raised eyebrows. Had this pastor never read Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1, or Colossians chapter 3, verse 20? Those passages simply instruct children to obey, and the only reason given is because a child's obedience is pleasing to God. A parent's authority is assigned by God. As such, a parent is called to reflect God's unconditional love and unequivocal authority. It is a sufficient reason for us to obey God because He is the one holy and almighty God, because He says so. That is, therefore, a sufficient reason why a child should obey his or her parents, assuming that they honor God in their parenting. Note that Paul does not say that children should obey their parents because their parents provide good reasons. Rather, children should obey in everything, simply because that's the way God wants it. Children who experience the joy of obedience to their parents are taking a huge first step toward experiencing the joy of obedience to God. To ponder and discuss. Do you often feel obligated to give your children good reasons for the decisions you make and the instructions you give them? If so, can you identify the social and cultural factors that have caused you to try to reason with your kids? Do you find yourself engaging in frequent unproductive arguments with your kids? Are you ready to reclaim your authority and stop arguing with children who are only satisfied when they win? 2. Children should be seen and not heard. I often conduct polls with my audiences, one of which illuminates the extent to which people believe that today's parenting is a great improvement over the old-fashioned stuff. I'll be standing in front of an audience of, say, 500 folks, and I'll say, "Raise your hand if you believe that children should be seen and not heard." Maybe 25 hands go up, most of which belong to people who, at a glance, look to be my age or thereabouts. "Okay," I say. "Now raise your hand again if you believe that when children are in a room otherwise occupied by adults who are having a conversation, it is right and proper for the children to pay attention to what is being said and to not do anything to attract attention to themselves." 500 hands go up. Isn't that fascinating? All I did, of course, was say the same thing twice. The first time I used the pre-1960s expression. The second time I translated it for the benefit of today's parents. The exercise illustrates the success of professional propaganda in causing modern parents to believe that pre-1960s parenting harmed children's psyches and should be disdained. This, of course, is not true in the least. Back then, child mental health was considerably better than it is today. School achievement and classroom behavior were much better as well. And it is a fact that back when children were told, on occasion, that if they wanted to listen to an adult conversation, they had to be seen and not heard. This put children in their proper role, student. It defined the adults as older, wiser, and more knowledgeable, people from whom the children, if they listened keenly to the conversation, and even if they did not understand all that was said, might learn something. As such, telling children that they were to be seen and not heard benefited them. Granted, it benefited the adults as well, because if the children consented to being seen and not heard, the adults would be able to carry on an uninterrupted conversation. But the primary benefit accrued to the children. I myself benefited on more than a few occasions. My mother and stepfather were very well-educated people who had a number of equally well-educated friends, physicians, scientists, college professors, and the like. There were many times when my parents took me along to dinner parties at their friends' homes. During the meal, we children sat at a separate table, much to our delight. On the way, my stepfather would remind me that when adults were talking, I was to be seen and not heard. That was fine with me. After dinner, the other kids, who had also been told to be seen and not heard, and I would sit in the room with the adults and listen while they talked about highly erudite things like the latest research into cell wall porosity or the relative merits of Mozart versus Beethoven. No, I'm not kidding. On the way home from these gatherings, where I felt like I'd been admitted to a meeting of superior beings, I'd ask my parents questions like, "What is a double helix?" And they would attempt to explain emerging DNA science in language a child my age could understand. My continuing love of science and high-minded questions concerning life's origins, and make no mistake, I am convinced beyond any doubt that all of the objective scientific evidence confirms the Genesis account of creation, started in those living rooms, listening as adults held high-minded conversations, being seen and not heard. It goes without saying that if I had been allowed to interject my impulsive thoughts into these conversations, I would not have learned nearly as much. I would have sidetracked these fascinating conversations. People would have felt the need to explain things to me, and because it is the nature of children, the more attention I received from these interruptions, the more I would have interrupted, and the less I would have learned. Was there a kinder, gentler way of telling me that I was to listen and not talk? Yes. My parents could have said, "Now, after dinner, the adults are going to gather in the living room and talk, and you may sit in the room and listen to us, but you are not to interrupt us. If you listen, you will learn something. Sound good?" Is that kinder and gentler? I suppose so, but that raises the question, would it have been more effective? Not a chance. "You are to be seen and not heard" was much more straightforward, and as such, it sounded far more authoritative. The kindler, gentler alternative sounds persuasive, as though the parents are asking children to please consider their request. In other words, children who are given the kinder, gentler version are more likely to interrupt. Children are much more likely to obey when instructions sound authoritative, as if the adults mean business, than when instructions sound persuasive. I did not interrupt these adult conversations because the expectation was stated concisely and authoritatively. It was clear to me that my parents were not making a request or a suggestion for me to take up with my internal committee of one. Relationships need borders, too. In a larger sense, children should be seen and not heard also refers to the fact that in those days a boundary existed between adult society and child society. Adults were adults and children were children, and the twain did not intermingle much at all. Furthermore, everyone understood, children included, that adults were superior to children. For these reasons, children looked up to adults. Adults belonged to an exclusive society that we children wanted someday to become members of. This society had its own language, its own jokes, and lots of subtleties, none of which we children understood. An adult would say something, and then there would be a moment of silence, and then everyone would laugh. What was so funny? And if one of us had the temerity to ask, "Why did everyone laugh?" an adult would smile and say, "Little pitchers have big ears," and everyone would laugh again. Boundaries are important to the functionality of relationships. The primary purpose of the adult-child relationship is to ensure that children receive the love they need to become compassionate and the leadership they need to become responsible. Compassion and responsibility make people good neighbors and good citizens. So by raising children properly, parents strengthen community bonds and strengthen America through the next generation. These purposes require that children pay attention to adults, that they look up, literally and figuratively, to adults. Looking up to adults causes children to aspire to become adults themselves. That requires a boundary between adults and children, a boundary that distinguishes adults as superior beings. The boundary in question also separates adults and children into two mostly separate worlds that overlap at times, but are distinct most of the time. Simply put, children need to know that they are children, knowledge that gives them freedom to fully enjoy their childhoods, and adults need to act like adults. This is a fact. Children are not going to look up to adults who act like they want to be or want the approval of children. Unfortunately, many adults today act like they want to be perceived by children as cool. To accomplish this silly goal, they eradicate any boundary between themselves and the children whose approval they seek. In so doing, they diminish themselves in the eyes of those kids. Those children would probably say they like those adults, but they do not truly respect them. When my daughter Amy was in high school, she began having a conflict with her drama teacher. He was young and wanted to be liked by his students. According to Amy, he had favorites, and she was not one of them. As is my inclination, I gave this teacher the benefit of the doubt, but kept a close eye on the situation. One day the teacher called, and I answered the phone. He launched into a series of complaints about Amy. I listened, and when he had finished, I told him that although I would always support his authority, I had the distinct impression that he was his own worst enemy. I shared with him my feeling that he was trying to be popular with certain students and was losing the respect of all of them as a consequence. He didn't seem to want to talk further, so the conversation ended. Many years later, I met him at a social gathering, and he reminded me of the time we had talked on the phone. He told me that although I'd stung his pride, I also caused him to think long and hard about his responsibilities. "You were absolutely right," he said. "That conversation caused me to be a much better teacher." As that story illustrates, boundaries are essential to facilitating mutual respect in a relationship. A woman who does not establish a boundary in relationships with men, for example, is not going to be respected by them. They may enjoy her company, under certain circumstances, but respect is out of the question. Those men will definitely take advantage of her. Likewise, adults who do not establish boundaries between themselves and children are not going to be respected by those kids. Again, the kids may like those adults, but respect is not synonymous with being liked. Those kids will try to manipulate the adults and take advantage of them, and they definitely will take the adults for granted. I'll say it again. Regardless of the nature of a relationship, a boundary is essential to respect. In the employer-employee relationship, it is up to the employer to establish and maintain the boundary. In the teacher-student relationship, it is up to the teacher to establish and maintain the boundary. And in the adult-child relationship, including the parent-child relationship, it is up to the adult to establish and maintain the boundary. That does not mean that adults and children cannot intermingle at times, have fun together, talk, or cuddle. It simply means that the intermingling, having fun, talking, or cuddling, takes place within the context of the unspoken understanding that adults are not the children's buddies, that they are first and foremost authority figures. If that understanding exists, the intermingling will be more satisfying to both parties anyway. It is a good thing for children to look up to and respect adults. That's also a good thing for adults, but the most good accrues to the children. When children aspire to become adults, they grow up faster. Because they are trying to gain the approval of adults, they become more competent more quickly. They pay better attention to teachers and other adults. They are more obedient, and the research is clear, and common sense confirms, that obedient children are much happier than disobedient children. Finally, appropriate adult-child boundaries promote early, successful emancipation. Appropriate boundaries between adults and children include sleeping in different beds, having access to different media, enjoying different amounts of freedom and different standards of living, and children being seen and not heard when adults are engaged in adult conversation. The Bible tells me so. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. Proverbs chapter 9, verse 10. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Psalm chapter 111, verse 10. Discipline is often thought of, rather simplistically, as the process by which a parent corrects misbehavior. Indeed, correction is one important aspect of discipline, but setting boundaries is equally important to the overall purpose. Boundaries serve several functions. They protect children from possible physical harm, keep them out of trouble, and create important distinctions between people. Concerning the latter, the most important interpersonal distinction that parents need to communicate to their children is the difference, the dividing line, if you will, between adults and children. This is absolutely necessary to defining children as disciples and parents and other adults as authority figures. An appropriate boundary in the parent-child relationship serves as a model for children's relationships to other adults. That boundary causes children to look up, both literally and figuratively. It is essential for causing children to respect their parents, respect that is then transferred to other adults whom the children's parents define as authority figures. It is unhealthy for children to fail to understand that they are not members of adult society. That understanding guarantees them a valid childhood. Therefore, the lack of that boundary denies them a valid childhood. A clearly defined adult-child boundary, which, again, begins with parents who communicate to their children that they are not their peers and certainly not members of their marriage, confers a separate, distinct identity upon children. As such, it greatly clarifies for them how the interpersonal world is organized and works. When boundaries operate properly, each person has a clear role comprised of unique responsibilities and privileges. The question then becomes, is there a biblical basis for establishing boundaries in the parent-child relationship? The answer is an unequivocal yes. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6 is perhaps the most well-known of all scriptures concerning parents and children. It tells parents to train their children in keeping with the adults they want them to become. This refers to a clear distinction between trainer and trainee, parent and child. Without such a distinction, children would have no reason to accept training from their parents. Bible passages that describe the benefits of fearing the Lord refer to the ultimate parent-child relationship. The word fear refers to awestruck reverence, not shaking in one's boots, although there may be times when such trembling is appropriate. I need not, I trust, point out the nature or extent of the boundary between God and man. I will only point out that ultimate respect for the ultimate parent requires an ultimate boundary, which has been breached once solely for mankind's benefit, and said breach did not weaken the ultimate nature of said boundary at all. To ponder and discuss. Do your children seem to think they are your peers, that whatever privileges you enjoy, they should enjoy as well? Do your children lack appropriate respect for you? If so, does this lack extend to other adults? Could you do a better job of describing and enforcing a boundary between you and your kids? How? 3. You made this bed, and now you're going to have to lie in it. "You've made this bed, and now you're going to have to lie in it," were some of the most dreaded words to come out of my parents' mouths. I'd just done something wrong, and I'd been caught, and I was in big trouble, and I was going to be punished. And I came to my parents and told them what I'd done, and asked them to help me by stepping in on my behalf and talking to the adult I was in trouble with, a teacher, perhaps, and trying to persuade him or her to lighten up. And my parents would look at each other and turn back to me, and one of them would say what I least wanted to hear. In other words, I was going to have to accept the consequences of what I had done. I had made a choice, and now I was going to experience the result of having made that choice. But more than that, "you made this bed" also meant that no one else was going to lie in that very uncomfortable bed with me. My parents certainly were not going to. They were not going to intervene in any way. They were not going to speak on my behalf, defend me, or come to my assistance in any other way, shape, or form. I was on my own, and believe me, the bed in question was the loneliest bed in the whole wide world. Here's a true story to illustrate the point. I became a major behavior problem in the 7th grade. I disrupted the class with inappropriate comments and other stupidities. Other kids, the boys mostly, laughed at my shenanigans, so I kept them up. These days I'd be tested, diagnosed, and medicated. Back then, I was simply punished. My parents, teachers, and the principal punished me over and over again, but to no avail. I was immune, or so I thought. I was a straight-A student, after all. What could they do to me? Keep me after school? Make me write sentences? So what? They had no power over me. I was too smart for them, as evidenced by my invention of the amazing multi-writer. 5 pens held together with rubber bands and tongue depressors, which enabled me to write 5 sentences simultaneously. One February afternoon, my parents went to my school for what I thought was a routine report card conference. They were gone longer than expected. When they came home, they sat me down, and my stepfather said, "I'm going to say this once and once only. If you are reprimanded by a teacher for any reason between now and the end of the school year, you are going to repeat the 7th grade next year." They both got up and walked out of the room as I sat there with my mouth hanging wide open. I got up and ran after them. "But what if the teacher who reprimands me is wrong?" I asked, panic-stricken. "What if I really didn't do it? What if it was someone else?" My stepfather said, "I've said all I'm going to say." And then they continued walking away. The next day, I demonstrated to my teachers how wrong they had been about me. I wasn't a behavior problem. Look, I was the best-behaved kid in the class. For the rest of that academic year, I never spoke out of turn. I completed all my work on time and then asked for extra work. I never laughed at someone else's joke. I faced forward only, and when a teacher called on me, I gave serious rather than sarcastic answers. My behavior disorder was cured in one day by 2 parents who made me lie in the very uncomfortable bed I had made. The notion that children should, for their own good, lie in the beds they make, that they should take full, unmitigated responsibility for their actions, has become nearly extinct. Who lies in the beds children make today? Parents, that's who. Today, children do something bad or fail to do something they should have done, and their parents end up feeling bad about it. It's axiomatic that the person who feels bad about the problem is the person who is going to do whatever it takes to solve it. And sure enough, today's parents can be counted on to solve problems their children create, whether through irresponsibility, malice, or just plain foolishness. And quite often the parents of whom I speak solve the problems by denying they exist or shifting the blame. A good example of this involves problems children create at school by either misbehaving or not doing the work they're supposed to do. When I was a kid and children were expected to lie in the beds they made, if children created problems at school, A, they were punished at school, then B, the teacher called home and informed their parents what had happened, and they were punished again at home. This very psychologically incorrect double whammy usually prevented recurrences of the problem in question. Today, children create problems at school, and A, they are not punished at school because schools have reason to fear lawsuits brought by parents who believe their kids are being treated unjustly by dastardly, vindictive, heartless people who became teachers in order to treat children with malice on a daily basis, and B, if teachers have the guts and gall to call the children's parents to report the problems, whatever they are, the parents are likely to defend their children. I'm not talking about all parents, of course, but enough that they deserve special mention. They actually deny what 30 or 40 or 50-year-old professionals who have dedicated their lives to the betterment of the lives of children are telling them is the truth. No, the teachers are lying, and the 7-year-old children are telling the truth. The parents know their children are telling the truth because They have never lied to us. That's what many of these parents say. So guess what? Teachers end up suffering for what children have done. Children make the beds, and teachers are ultimately forced, often by administrators who just want to keep peace, to lie in them. The list goes on. A 6-year-old bites another child in school, and the biter's parents claim that the fault belongs to the bitten child. He asked for it by annoying their 6-year-old. A 10-year-old girl sends another girl an inappropriate text message, and her parents respond to the other parent's complaint by telling them that their daughter is immature and shouldn't have a cell phone anyway. A 16-year-old is arrested for driving under the influence, and his parents hire the best lawyer in town to defend him. Those are real-life examples, by the way. What are the benefits of children lying in the beds they make, of having no parental buffer between their actions and the consequences of those actions? The most immediate benefit of having to accept full responsibility for misbehavior is no longer misbehaving. Lying on a bed of nails that they have made for themselves is the best guarantee that children will never repeat whatever resulted in them having to lie on a bed of nails. And make no mistake, as I continue to say at every possible opportunity, misbehavior is an impediment to personal satisfaction, otherwise known as happiness. The most obedient kids are also the best adjusted kids. And be assured, having obedient children is not an accident, a random genetic event. It is the result of parents who insist upon obedience and hold children completely responsible for their every action. Last but not least, children who lie in the beds they make are going to be prepared for successful emancipation at an earlier age than would otherwise be the case. The average age at which males attain complete economic independence has increased from 21 in 1970 to nearly 28 by 2010. I'm convinced that this dramatic increase is largely the result of failing to hold children completely responsible for their behavior and of parents who run perpetual interference for their kids. To summarize, the benefits of children having to lie in the beds they make are good behavior, happiness, and earlier emancipation. What more could children want? Or their parents, for that matter. The Bible tells me so. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. Throughout the Old Testament, we read that on one occasion after another, God made the Israelites lie in beds they had made for themselves. They paid for their idol worship during the Exodus by having to wander in the Sinai desert for 40 years, for example. They paid again for their apostasies by being defeated in war and taken to Babylon. Like children, God's chosen people were slow learners. Sooner or later, bad things happen to people who do bad things. That principle is as much a part of God's design as the speed of light or the laws of thermodynamics. It is vital to children's proper socialization, not to mention a right understanding of their proper relationship and responsibilities to God, that they come to grips with that fundamental principle. To ponder and discuss. Do you regularly allow your children to lie in the beds they have made? If not, why not? Are you reluctant to do anything that would cause your children to be upset with you? When you do something that causes them to be upset, do you feel that you may have done the wrong thing? What can you do today to begin allowing them to lie in beds they make? 4. You are a little fish in a big pond. If I heard it once, I heard it 100 times. No matter how much you accomplish in this world, John Roseman, one of my parents would lecture, you would do well to to always remember that you are really just a little fish in a big pond. I always felt like saying, "No, I'm not going to be a little fish. I've got dreams. I'm going to be a big fish." But I didn't. I just stood there and looked at them, wondering why they felt the need to keep saying this to me. I now realize they kept saying it to me because they knew I wanted to be a big fish. In fact, by the time I was in the 7th grade, I already thought I was one. Remember my story in Chapter 3. So here I am, 50 or so years later, and in many people's eyes, I am a big fish. I'm a nationally, even internationally, known parenting expert. I've written 20 books, many of which are bestsellers in the parenting field. My syndicated newspaper column appears weekly in about 200 newspapers. I am one of the most in-demand public speakers in my field. People frequently recognize me in restaurants, in malls, in airports, and on airplanes, and on the street. I'm a big fish, right? One of my favorite musicians is Doug Somm, whose original group, the Sir Douglas Quintet, was famous for the hit "She's About a Mover." Somm's music blended lots of American roots influences into a unique sound. He titled one of his songs, "You Never Get Too Big and You Sure Don't Get Too Heavy, That You Don't Have to Stop and Pay Some Dues Sometime." It's got to be the longest song title of all time. In the 1980s, when I realized that I was becoming fairly well known for my iconoclastic parenting advice, I thought of that song, and I've kept it in mind ever since. That, along with my parents' repetitious reminders to the effect that I'm a small fish, has kept me from becoming too big for my britches, from thinking the world revolves around me, from thinking of myself as a big fish. I've had the opportunity to meet people who obviously think they are big fish. I once realized, for example, that I was sitting less than 5 feet from one of the most famous basketball players in history. The word legendary applies. We were waiting for the same airplane. I said, "Excuse me, but my son is a huge fan of yours. Would you be willing to autograph this piece of paper to Eric? He'd be thrilled beyond belief." Big Fish looked at me with complete disdain and went back to reading his newspaper. I think that meant no. I bumped into a famous country music singer in an airport once and asked him to sign a piece of paper to my secretary, who was a big fan of his. He smiled, signed, and wished me a blessed day. I instantly became a fan as well. Then there was the time I met a major political figure and his wife in the dining area of a bed and breakfast in New York. We were speaking at the same conference. During my standing, face-to-face conversation with MPF, his wife suddenly wedged her body between mine and his, her back to me, and began speaking to him as if I weren't there. Then, without so much as a "nice to meet you," they left the building. I won't identify her other than to say she has since become a leading figure in American politics. Then there was the guy I shared the green room with as we were waiting for our respective turns on The View. You'd know his name, for sure. A famous American actor, spokesperson for a major cause, and all that la-di-da. There we were in the waiting room, just two average, ordinary guys, or so I thought. I tried to strike up a conversation along the lines of, "Did you fly in from Los Angeles?" Without looking up from the magazine he was reading, might have been an article about himself, he mumbled something that sounded vaguely like yes. Maybe I could bond with him, I thought, if I let him know I've watched his films. So I said, "I thought you were very good in his latest movie." Mumble. Okay, he got his point across. I was not worth talking to. I was a nobody. The almighty him, on the other hand, was a somebody, a big fish, And Big Fish was not going to stoop to give Johnny Little Fish Rosamond the time of day. When you meet a person who actually believes he or she is a big fish, it's almost startling. If they don't manage to make you feel like slime, you realize they have a major, pronounced character defect. They refuse to accept the truth about themselves, that no matter what they've accomplished, no matter how many people know their names, no matter how many people think they're wonderful, they are really just little fish in a big pond. Or, as Doug Somm put it, you never get too big, and you sure don't get too heavy, that you don't have to stop and pay some dues sometime. Their parents must have never told them what my parents told me about little fish in big ponds. That's too bad, because I know only too well that coming to grips with the fact that you're a little fish is what keeps your feet on solid ground and your head out of the intoxicating clouds of perpetual self-delusion. The paradox is that little fish do big things. They pay attention to other people, for starters. They look for opportunities to do things for other people. They try to help other people feel comfortable. They try to make other people feel like they're worth something. Children need to learn early on that being a little fish is the way one thanks God for the gift of human life. You thank God for the gift of human life by treating other human beings, with whom you share that gift, with respect, kindness, compassion, charity, and care. God loves you, and you thank God for His inestimable love by sharing it with others. The problem is that children are inclined toward wanting to think of themselves as big fish. That's what toddler tantrums are all about. Their legendary rages occur because they believe they deserve to have what they want, and their parents are obligated, therefore, to give it to them on demand. At least 95% of toddler tantrums have nothing to do with need or pain. They are all about want. Toddlers possess a selfish nature and want the people in their world to feed it constantly. Their selfish nature decides it wants something, and that's that. If the adults in question do not give it to them, they go into a rage. Toddlers' selfish nature is the big fish. Their parents' job is to teach them that they're really little fish, that being little fish is the only valid way to live. That's a tough job, because it requires that their parents face directly into the hurricane and refuse to budge. If they can manage to do that, the hurricane will burn itself out by the time the children are around 3 years old. If the parents budge, by giving in to the tantrums or throwing tantrums of their own, the hurricane succeeds in moving them, in other words, then the hurricane gets stronger, and they will have more and more difficulty standing up to it. This is done for the children's sake, not the parents. It goes without saying that children who do not throw tantrums are a lot happier than children who do. Children who accept no are a lot happier than children who believe they can change no to yes by turning themselves into Category 5 hurricanes. Likewise, children who come to grips with the fact that they're little fish in a big pond are a lot happier than children who are allowed to continue thinking they're big fish. The three real-life big fish I described, do you think they're happy campers? Of course not. They may have money. They may enjoy, if that's the proper word, celebrity status, but they are not happy campers. How do I know? Because people can only be truly happy, meaning they are, first, completely satisfied with their lives, and second, that their satisfaction is not tied to material things or prestige. If they take my parents' words to heart and realize that no matter how much they accomplish in this world, they are really just little fish in a big pond. Thank you, Mom and Dad, for teaching me one of the most valuable lessons of all. Would that all parents would do the same. Maybe then the 6 o'clock news would be about happy stuff. The Bible tells me so. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 7, English Standard Version. If the first thing everyone in the world, rich, poor, famous, ordinary, workers, owners, rulers, the ruled, did upon waking up every morning was read Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 11, think of how much better life on this earth would be. We have the opportunity to obtain eternal life because God made himself into a little fish, made himself nothing, as Paul puts it. What a concept! Children need to learn that we honor what Jesus did for all of us by taking on his character in our dealings with others. Children need to learn that the purpose of life is to serve, not to be served. Reference Matthew chapter 20, verse 28. Their lives depend on it. To ponder and discuss. Do your kids sometimes act like they think they're big fish? Can you identify ways in which you may have fostered that belief? What are some ways you can help your kids grasp the fact that God wants little fish? 5. I knew if I gave you enough rope, you'd hang yourself. In my senior year of high school, I wanted more than anything else to qualify as cool, with it, groovy, fab, and other dated adjectives of the sort. I'd been a nerdy four eyes for too long. However, there was a slight problem. The kids who occupied the top tier of the popularity pyramid had made it perfectly clear I didn't measure up. By default, I fell in with a group of four guys who skirted the edges of delinquency. To my knowledge, none of them had ever been arrested, but that was soon to change. One of them, his name was Terry, received a 1965 Pontiac GTO from his parents for graduation. Back then, this was the car of every high school boy's dreams. That summer, the five of us spent long hours cruising in Terry's tray cool ride. We were looking for girls, of course, although how we thought we were going to fit anyone else in the car is beyond me. One gorgeous summer day, we were driving around a residential neighborhood that lay within the feeder zone of our high school when a car full of guys passed us going in the other direction. We recognized them as students from a rival high school. How outrageous! They were looking for girls in our territory. We quickly swung around the block and passed them again. This time we yelled various slurs at them, mostly impugning their parentage. Sure enough, they yelled various equally impugning slurs back at us. Both cars drove around the block again and stopped, facing one another, at the intersection of two normally quiet suburban lanes. The cars emptied, and what ensued was straight out of West Side Story. A tire iron suddenly appeared, then a set of tire chains, then a baseball bat, then another tire iron. Fairly equally armed for a fight to the death, the two groups faced off, hurling insults. Thankfully, and despite brain-numbing surges of testosterone, we still possessed enough of our wits to realize that if this went any further, someone could get killed. So it was quickly agreed that the best fighter from each crew would do battle, fists only. The lucky chosen ones circled each other, making the occasional feint, when suddenly police cars screamed down upon us from all four directions at once, obviously a carefully coordinated military maneuver designed to cut off any attempt at escape. We were all arrested, taken to the local station, and booked. The desk sergeant began calling our parents. When he called mine, this is what we all heard. "Hello, is this John Roseman's mother? This is Sergeant O'Malley of the Westchester Police. We have your son in custody for disturbing the peace and participating in a gang fight, and we'd like for you to come get him." "Yes, that's right. He was arrested with 8 other boys." "No, no one was hurt." "Yes, I can wait." And then, less than a minute later, "Yes, ma'am. Well, that's somewhat unusual, but I suppose we can do that. How long would you like us to keep him?" Everyone in the room turned in my direction, and someone said, "Rosemond, I think your parents are leaving you here." Sure enough, they left me to rot in jail. My single-occupant cell was furnished with a sink, a toilet, and a metal cot. It lacked soap, towel, mattress, and blanket, and I was unable to persuade the jailer to provide them. After 2 nights that seemed like several months, my parents paid my bail and took me home, where I was confined for the remaining 8 weeks of the summer, during which I washed walls, painted the exterior of our bungalow, and pulled every dandelion in our yard by hand. I never saw the other members of the suburban stupid gang again. During that summer, one of my stepfather's comments became stuck forever in my mind. "I knew if I gave you enough rope, you'd hang yourself." In other words, he and my mother disapproved of the company I was keeping, suspected our mischief would eventually come to the attention of John Law, and had probably even discussed the what-if of my arrest long before it actually happened. It sure didn't take them any time at all to make the decision to let me soak up the ambiance of a jail cell for a couple of days. In short, they were reasonably certain I was headed for big trouble, but did absolutely nothing to prevent it. Their strategy was nothing short of brilliant. Let's face it, had my parents tried to prevent me, a high school graduate, from hanging with Terry and his crew, I would have found a way to hang with them anyway. Had they warned me that I was headed for all but certain legal trouble, I would have ignored them. They knew this, of course, and realized that teaching me the lesson I needed to learn required invoking the long rope principle. Needless to say, that entire experience made a huge imprint on me. 18 years later, my parents' brilliant strategy paid off for my son, Eric. At age 14, Eric took up with a group of boys that all lived in the most expensive gated neighborhood in our hometown and began spending every spare minute with them. One summer afternoon, I received a phone call from a friend who lived in the aforementioned enclave. He told me the boys Eric was running with were known vandals who had perpetrated considerable damage to various upscale homes, usually while the occupants were out of town. The boys' parents, enablers all, refused to accept that their kids were behind these crimes. "I figured you'd want to know so you and Willie can put an end to the relationship before it goes any further," he said. Willie and I talked and decided on a variation of my parents' long rope strategy. We sat down with Eric, told him what we had learned, without naming our informant, of course, and assured him we were going to do nothing to prevent him from continuing to associate with the boys in question. "You can see them and be with them as much as you like," I said. I went on to explain that my anonymous friend had agreed to let me know the next time an act of vandalism occurred in his neighborhood. "If such an act comes to our attention, Eric, and you cannot account for your whereabouts with a responsible adult witness, you will pay the victims the entire cost of their repairs. Even if the other boys' parents step up to the plate and pay their shares, you will still pay the entire amount, and you will be allowed to do nothing but earn money by doing work for other people until the entire amount is paid. In the meantime, you have our full permission to hang with those boys as much as you like." Eric was looking at us like we'd just told him we were space aliens who had kidnapped his real parents and imprisoned them on a distant planet until he and his sister were old and wealthy enough to pay some impossibly huge ransom. Okay, was all he said. No more than 2 weeks later, I was mowing the grass when I looked up to see Eric racing down the street on his bike. When he reached our driveway, he sent his ride sliding into the grass as he hopped off and ran over to me. "Dad! Dad!" he yelled. I turned off the mower. "Dad, I was with those guys, and they started planning something bad, and I told them I had to go to a dentist appointment and left. And, Dad, believe me, if you hear something, I wasn't there. And, Dad, I'm not going to hang with those guys ever again. I promise. I'm going to find new friends." As I assured him I believed his story and told him how proud I was of him, I silently thanked my mom and stepdad for helping me, in the most paradoxical of ways, to be a better parent. Again, had my parents made any attempt to keep me from hanging with the suburban stupid gang, I would simply have taken the relationship underground. I'm sure the same would have been the case with Eric and the spoiled brats he'd taken up with. Who knows where those deceptions would have eventually led? In both cases, thankfully, application of the long rope principle saved the day and prevented who knows what sort of trouble. When I tell someone my age of my long rope story, it is more common than not for them to share a long rope story from their own childhood. We always agree that our parents' restraint was in our best interests, that it conveyed invaluable lessons that could not have been conveyed as effectively in any other way. In other words, those 2 days spent in jail were two of the most beneficial days of my life, and Eric's, too. Today's parents, when they suspect their kids are headed for trouble, swing into action. They do whatever is necessary to cut the trouble off at the proverbial pass. This knee-jerk reaction is certainly well-intentioned, and there are certain situations in which it is appropriate. I am by no means suggesting that the long rope principle be applied across the board. I am suggesting, however, that like letting children stew in their own juices and lie in beds they themselves make, giving children a long rope is sometimes the best of all parental strategies. It sure paid off handsomely for Eric. From then on, he chose his friends much, much more carefully. The Bible tells me so. The Bible tells of God employing the long rope principle on numerous occasions, the first of which is in the Garden of Eden. He gives Adam and Eve, the first man and first woman, a single commandment and the freedom to break that commandment. Rather than hovering over their shoulders, he doesn't stick around to make sure they follow the rule and allows them to make their own bad decision. Many, many years later, Jesus employed the long rope principle with Judas. Matthew's account of the Last Supper, chapter 26, verses 17 through 30, makes perfectly clear that Jesus knew of Judas's betrayal. He knew all along, of course, and yet he allowed Judas to hold what was perhaps the highest administrative post within the disciples, treasurer. Furthermore, Jesus did nothing to dissuade Judas from his date with the devil, nothing to prevent him from doing what he did. Knowing full well what Judas was all about, he gave him a long rope. And sure enough, Judas hanged himself, literally. God is not a micromanager. I'm fully aware, by the way, that there are theologians who both agree and disagree with me on that issue, but I think most of them, on both sides, would agree that neither position is vital to salvation. In that regard, God is a model of effective parenting. Would we expect anything less? Micromanaging parents are certainly motivated by the good intention of keeping their kids out of trouble, and there are indeed certain troubles that parents should do all they can to prevent. Nonetheless, when proper management crosses the line and becomes micromanagement, parents unwittingly deny their children immensely valuable learning experiences that come from feeling the consequences of their bad decisions. To ponder and discuss. Can you identify a time or times when you intervened to head off trouble on behalf of one of your kids, and in so doing prevented him or her from learning a lesson that only trouble can properly teach? Are there potentially problematic situations currently looming in your kids' lives that might call for the long rope principle? What is the one way you can both prevent the worst harm possible and still allow your children to learn what only bad consequences can teach? 6. You have to learn to stand on your own two feet. My mother was a single parent for most of the first 7 years of my life. During much of that time, we lived in a walk-up apartment in what is now the historic district of Charleston, South Carolina. It would have been more accurately described as the rundown district back then. She was a student at the College of Charleston and worked part-time at the post office to make ends meet. She had a car, a 1950 English Anglia, but drove it sparingly. She mostly walked, so she understood, tangibly, the value of learning to stand on one's own two feet. When she was a child, her parents had divorced. Her mother had taken her and her three younger siblings back to the family home, Rose Hill Plantation, just outside of Hilton Head, where my mother remembered living for only a brief time until the state evicted them for failure, inability, to pay the tax on the property. Essentially homeless and without means of support, Grandmother Webb appealed to the Episcopal Church, who placed the children at the Episcopal Children's Home, an orphanage, essentially, in York, South Carolina. My mother spent most of her childhood and early teen years, during the Great Depression, there. She married when she was 18 and right out of high school. My father was an outgoing, charming, talented man with deep-seated sociopathic tendencies that he didn't bring under control until he was in his 60s, when he found the Lord. Better late than never. My parents divorced when I was a toddler. Mom remarried when I was almost 7, and my stepfather, Julius, took us to Chicago. This was 1953. Talk about culture shock. My mother's second marriage was a slow-motion disaster. Julius possessed an impressive intellect and a good sense of humor, but was emotionally, well, the current term is challenged. Like my mother, he'd experienced more than his share of hardship during the Depression. Empathy and compassion were not his strong suits. Nonetheless, my mother stayed with him, unwilling to admit to her family, I think, that she had made another bad matrimonial decision. After living in apartments for several years, we moved into a modest bungalow in one of Chicago's suburbs, and Mom began attending college. She eventually earned her Ph.D. in plant morphology, an esoteric branch of the life sciences, and she taught and did research until her retirement. She was a smart, pretty, and emotionally fragile woman. Life had beaten her up a lot. Mind you, her coping skills were considerable. They had simply been overwhelmed. This story ends well, however. After Julius passed, her dazzling personality gradually reemerged, and she began attending church. She passed peacefully at 86, having found her way back to a relationship with Christ. Determined to prepare me for life's slings and arrows, Mom was anything but an enabler. As a parent, she had a long-term vision, one she would remind me of on those occasions when I would come to her complaining of how difficult and unfair something was, and asking her to solve whatever it was for me. "It's my job, John Rosemond, to help you learn to stand on your own two feet, and you are not going to learn to stand on yours if I let you stand on mine." But But, Mom, I'd protest, searching for words that would change her mind. There'll be no buts about this, she would say. Now run along. One such occasion involved a fifth-grade math assignment. Stumped, I came to her complaining that I didn't understand the process and asking for her help. Mind you, I'm asking this of a woman who is a research scientist, mathematician, and a statistician. For her, fifth-grade math was no big deal. She took the book from me, turned several pages, and then handed it back to me, saying, "I figured this out when I was your age, and so can you." I was stunned. Then she said what has caused me to remember this encounter for life. "And let me remind you, when I was your age, I was in an orphanage. I had no one to go to for help, and I figured this out." And then she repeated, "So can you." Being a child, I did not hear, "So can you." I heard only that she was not going to give me any help. In other words, I heard her with the ears of a child. Obviously, the most important thing she said was, "So can you." She was telling me that I did not need her help, that I was as smart and capable as she was, and that she was not about to cooperate in my "I can't" drama. Folly is a child. Scripture says, "Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child." Proverbs chapter 22, verse 15. Children are drama factories, and many of their self-dramas are a variation of one sort or another on the "I can't" theme. Because they have short attention spans, and their need for instant gratification is strong, when children encounter a difficult problem, they are not inclined to roll up their proverbial shirt sleeves and get to work. They fold. They complain. They produce drama, soap operas in which they are victims in desperate need of rescue. Most of this is foolishness, or as some translations of Proverbs chapter 22, verse 15 put it, folly. Mom was not about to indulge my folly. She had a larger, more long-range vision of her purpose than was represented by the fifth-grade math assignment I was complaining about. If her vision had extended no further into the future than the grade I was going to receive the next day on my assignment, she would have helped me. But her purpose was not about a fifth-grade math assignment. It was about the assignments and problems I would encounter as an adult. But the story's not over. Upon hearing her remind me that she had been in an orphanage, and hearing her with the ears of a child, and wanting her to enable rather than challenge the foolishness in my heart, I said, "But, Mom, I know you were in an orphanage, but this isn't an orphanage. This is our house, and you're not some orphanage lady. You're my mother, and you know how to do this stuff, and I'm just asking for your help." And she calmly said, "Well, I've already told you. I'm not going to help you, and that's that." And then, with a wave of her hand, she said, "Now run along." And I was dismissed from Her Majesty's presence. I am reasonably certain that after much gnashing of teeth and blaspheming of my mother under my breath, I figured out the assignment. Generally speaking, children are much, much more capable than they think they are. After a talk during which I had told this story, a woman approached me and asked, "What if you really had not been able to figure it out, John? Would your mother have helped you then?" This was a good question, and my answer was, and is, I honestly doubt it. This was, after all, a woman who once made me sit at the dinner table until I finally, close to midnight, worked up the courage to eat a few forkfuls of broccoli. She was much more determined than I was. Her strength of will could better mine on my most obstinate days. Had I not been able to figure out the problem, and had I come to her in tears an hour or so later, I'm fairly certain she would have said something along these lines. "No one solves all the problems life throws at them. If you don't figure out that math assignment, your life won't end." In other words, Mom was not concerned with whether I succeeded on a fifth grade assignment. She was concerned with whether I succeeded at life. In that regard, I needed to learn that A, I was not going to solve all the problems life threw at me. B, I must choose whether failure to solve some problem is a positive or negative experience. C, I must determine always to do my best. And D, failure becomes a failing only if I choose. People succeed at life not because of strong math skills. They succeed at life because of strength of character. That was Mom's purpose. As a parent, she was far-sighted. It paid off for both of us. I emancipated and married my wife for life, Willie, when I was 20. I was a parent, supporting a family of three at 21. I have lots of shortcomings, Lord knows, but not being able to stand on my own two feet is not one of them. Thanks, Ma. The Bible tells me so. The people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes, and when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. Numbers chapter 11, verses 1 through 2, English Standard Version. Do all things without complaining and disputing. Philippians chapter 2, verse 14. Standing on one's own two feet requires perseverance. Perseverance requires us to push through rather than grumble, even, and especially, when circumstances are difficult. The Bible is full of stories of people who persevered and eventually succeeded in the face of tremendous adversity. To cite one prominent example, can you just imagine what the world would be like today if 20 or so years into the seemingly endless wandering the Lord had meted out to the Israelites, Moses had said, "I've had enough of these people. My feet are worn out, and so is my patience, and I'm tired of eating nothing but this manna stuff. I'm done." What would have happened if he had taken his rod and robe and gone back to a reasonably comfortable life herding livestock in Midian? The prophets, all of them, are exemplars of perseverance. None of them gave up, even though that would have been the logical choice. But there are no better examples of a tenacious spirit than the disciples. When the mob stoned Stephen, the disciples would have had every right to return to their previously comfortable lives as fishermen and so on. Instead, they never complained. They pushed on, knowing that horrible earthly fates lay just down the road. God wants believers who will stand up and stand strong in the face of whatever hardships the world throws their way. The earlier that training begins, the better. To ponder and discuss. Do you think you're doing a good job of helping your children learn to stand on their own two feet? If not, what can you do to help your children develop that spirit? Perhaps more important, what can you stop doing? Are there problems or issues in your children's lives where you've been too helpful, perhaps to the point of becoming an enabler? What excuses on your part are rationalizing and supporting that enabling? How might allowing your children to figure things out on their own improve these problems and issues? 7. You will have to learn your lessons the hard way. According to my parents, I was going to have to learn my lessons the hard way because I had a thick skull and potatoes in my ears. Sometimes, however, my auditory canals must have been clear of potatoes because the things they told me went in one ear and out the other. My parents did not seem the least bit concerned about my cranial and auditory infirmities, however. They knew their influence in my life did not extend to such things. Therefore, I was going to have to learn certain lessons the hard way. They were, as usual, precisely on the money. Today's parents, by contrast, seem to believe that if they use proper words in a proper sequence, they can cause their children to understand the life lessons they are trying to communicate. "What can I say to my son?" asked the mother of a 14-year-old. "To help him understand that by trying harder in school, he increases his chances of getting into a good college." "How can I get my daughter," asked the father of a 10-year-old, "to understand that she is causing her own social difficulties by bossing other girls around?" "Are there words I can use," asked the mother of a 17-year-old, "to help my daughter understand that she doesn't need attention from boys to feel worthwhile?" Parents frequently ask me these sorts of questions. In each of these real-life examples, the parent can see the problem clearly and desperately wants to help the child understand and solve it. In each case, the parent is motivated by nothing but love for the child. And in each case, the parent is searching for words that don't exist, because in each case, the child has a hard head and potatoes clogging his or her ears, and is, therefore, going to have to learn the needed lesson the hard way, through first-hand experience with certain facts of life. Knowing this simple and timeless truth, parents of old dedicated themselves not to making happiness in their children's lives, but to making reality. They gave children freedom to fall flat on their faces, or, as my parents sometimes put it, enough rope to hang yourself, knowing that children must fall down before they can learn how to not fall down and must mess up in order to grow up. Many of today's parents, by contrast, believe that failure in any form chips away large chunks of a child's self-esteem. As a consequence, they protect their kids from reality to such an extent that those kids don't learn what reality is until they're young adults. Then, in order to avoid dealing with it for the longest possible time, they continue to live at home until who knows when. Since 1976, the percentage of children 22 and older still living at home, largely dependent upon parental support, has doubled. It's clear that many of these children are looking for an indefinite extension of the guarantee their parents have always provided, to wit, you will never have to learn anything the hard way. In the previous examples, there is no amount of parental talk that will cause the child in question to understand what the parent wants him or her to understand. No words will suddenly penetrate the child's thick skull or drill through the child's ear potatoes and cause said child to suddenly exclaim, "Mom, Dad, I get it. You're absolutely right. Wow! Thank you for helping me understand I've been on the wrong path. This conversation has been life-changing. I love you guys." Nope. Children will understand the life lessons their parents want them to understand when they are adults. Make that when they are the parents of children their present age. Someday the child with ear potatoes will be a parent trying to get a child with ear potatoes to understand something that a child cannot understand. Which is why you're going to have to learn certain things the hard way is as valid today as it was in the 1950s when I first heard it. And by the way, I did not have a clue what my parents were talking about. The hard way? What's that? I finally figured out what it meant, courtesy of more than one hard way experience. During the early years of our marriage, Willie and I endured my being fired from two jobs. I had a huge problem with authority. Living hand to mouth with two children, but we always managed to pay our bills, and suffering the almost inevitable emotional consequences of marrying young and having two children before we'd completely adjusted to just being married. We now realize that through these physical and emotional hardships, the Lord was preparing us for a ministry assignment. He hardened us, if you will, with one hard way after another. This probably sounds strange, but bear with me, please. I love going through the checkout line at grocery stores. I don't even mind having to wait on someone ahead of me who has a cart overflowing with what looks like enough food to feed an army for a month, because I get a kick out of reading the covers of the various tabloids in the checkout racks. I am always amused by the latest dramas coming out of Hollywood. Stupid affairs, pardon the redundancy, marriages on the rocks, messy divorces, child custody and alimony battles, botched plastic surgeries, weight issues. Traumatized by winning an Oscar, so-and-so loses 80 pounds, then gains 200. Wrinkle issues. Once glamorous star, now afraid to be seen in public. Bankruptcies. Crazy relatives. My mother stole all my money. Phobias. Childhood traumas. I can finally admit it. I failed kindergarten. Mansions slowly sliding off seaside cliffs. Nervous breakdowns. Not-so-nervous breakdowns. The list goes on and on, creating the impression that no one on the planet lives or has ever lived a tougher life than a grossly overpaid Hollywood celebrity. Yes, cynical as it may be, standing in the checkout line is one of my favorite recreations. The celebrities who populate these tabloid covers are in serious need of some real hardship, like the hardship of being a West Virginia coal miner with a wife and five kids whose mine just closed because a bunch of pampered politicians decided that burning coal is politically incorrect. Or the hardship of being a Christian in Africa who lives with the constant fear of persecution by people representing a certain religion that I cannot mention because its adherents might be offended. Or the hardship of being the wife of an American soldier who has been killed in battle in some desert country halfway around the globe. Or, for that matter, the hardship of being an American soldier who is fighting in some desert country halfway around the globe to advance the cause of freedom for people he doesn't know and who may not appreciate his sacrifice. The point is, there is real hardship in this broken world, but its address is not in Hollywood. Valuable lessons are learned the hard way. In fact, the harder the way, the more valuable the lesson. One of the responsibilities of being a parent is to protect children from hardships they truly cannot handle. It's equally true, however, that one of the responsibilities of being a parent is to prepare children for hardship. That is done by simply letting them have a controlled taste every now and then of what real life is all about, by letting them fall flat on their faces, run into proverbial brick walls, be disappointed, experience failure, be rejected, not be chosen, be treated unfairly, and so on. Doing bad things to children is pure evil, but preparing children for bad stuff is an act of love. The Bible tells me so. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, English Standard Version. Indeed, all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 12. English Standard Version. A currently popular saying has it that life is hard and then you die. It's a bit of an exaggeration, for most people, that is, but it effectively makes the point that life is not a bed of roses or a bowl of cherries. At the very least, life's a bed of roses that conceals many thorns, or a bowl of cherries with some deadly nightshade thrown in for good measure. The Bible makes it as clear can be, that nothing good in this life is ever achieved except through hard work and hardship. Life's hardships, if endured properly with a heart turned toward Christ, usually have positive outcomes beyond expectation, including the most positive and glorious outcome of all, eternal life with God. to ponder and discuss. Have you done too good a job of protecting your children from hardship? Have you broken too many falls, too often prevented them from coming into contact with brick walls, righted all the wrongs in their lives, and made sure everything that happened to them was fair? Do you think you can prepare them for real life simply by talking to them? Does it seem, more often than not, that your talking is falling on deaf ears? Are you ready to stop talking so much and begin helping them develop the coping skills they are going to need to deal with life's inevitable misfortunes? What can you do within the next week to begin that process? 8. Every child has a mind of his own. Sigmund Freud, the so-called father of modern psychology, popularized the idea that the manner in which a child is raised determines the adult he or she becomes, that parenting produces the person. Freud used hypnosis, primarily, to help his patients reconnect with childhood experiences that he believed, and persuaded his patients to believe, had shaped their personalities and were responsible for whatever symptoms they presented. Although none of Freud's theories have been proved, they are still taught in university psychology programs as if they contain significant validity, when they are really nothing more than the wild speculations of a person who was himself, by all accounts, fairly troubled. Freud's theories are why psychologists probe the childhoods of their patients. They're attempting to make cause and effect connections between the various emotional problems that adults bring to their attention and the manner in which those adults were raised. And of course, no matter what sort of childhood a particular patient had, good, bad, or unremarkable, a psychologist will discover a connection. Freud's deterministic theories made the jump from academia to popular culture in the 1950s and 1960s. As a consequence, parents slowly became convinced that parenting errors on their part had the potential to mess their kids up for life. Furthermore, no parent could escape the wide throw of Freud's net. The strict parent who enforced high standards was raising a future obsessive-compulsive neurotic, while the permissive, relaxed parent was raising an adult who would bounce from identity crisis to identity crisis, never able to figure out a clear purpose to his or her life. In between were parents who raised run-of-the-mill, garden-variety, plain old, messed-up people. Prior to the popularization of Freudian theory, parents understood that children will sometimes, and for some children often, do things that are completely unrelated to anything their parents have or have not done. In other words, children will misbehave and do various odd, inexplicable things no matter what. Parents can minimize the possibility, perhaps, but not eliminate it. A dog trainer once told me that you train children the same way you train dogs. I told him there are fundamental differences. For example, if someone trains a puppy properly, it will never be a problem. With children, however, all bets are off. Parents can train children properly, and the children will still, occasionally, be a problem, and maybe even more often than just occasionally. The difference between puppies and children is the latter's free will, minds of their own. Today's parents, mothers especially, tend to believe that parenting produces the child, and by extension, the person the child becomes. They believe, in other words, that children do not have minds of their own, that they are the sum total of their parents' actions toward them. The only thing this Freudian falsehood produces is tremendous anxiety and guilt for mothers. Why mothers and not so much fathers? Because, generally speaking, men do not consume parenting materials. Overwhelmingly, women are the primary consumers of parenting stuff, most of which qualifies as unmitigated babble. As a consequence, it is primarily women whose thinking becomes infected with the misinformation, unfounded theories, and downright dumb advice that characterizes most of the babble in question. As they read parenting materials, not all, mind you, but definitely most, women open their brains to invasion by what I call psychological bogeymen, which most of today's parenting books and magazines are full of. These bogeymen scrabble around in their brains, drowning out the calming voice of good, old-fashioned, non-intellectual common sense. Women of my mother's generation and earlier did not believe they had to read in order to be good mothers. They believed child-rearing was a natural process God had equipped human beings to do, the way he had also equipped geese and wolves and dogs and cats and elephants to do, and any responsible person could be trusted to do it reasonably well. Those women were also familiar with the Genesis story of Adam and Eve, in which we learn that the one and only perfect parent there is or ever will be creates two children who disobey his first instruction. As soon as their father's back is turned, those two first children do the very worst thing they could have possibly done. What parenting fault in God caused this fault in his first kids? None, because God has no faults. Therefore, the only possible explanation for Adam and Eve's misbehavior is that every child has a mind of his own. No matter how well, by any standard, children are raised, they are still capable of engaging in all manner of egregious behavior. In Psalm chapter 51, verse 5, David writes, "Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me." New International Version. Human beings are inclined toward sin, toward doing what is self-gratifying without regard for others, from day one. Human beings are moral relativists by nature. Mothers of 3+ generations ago, when biblical principles still held sway in America, understood that no amount of good mothering could neutralize that inconvenient fact. Children, it was generally agreed, were fundamentally bad. They could not be made good. They could only be taught, through firm discipline lovingly applied, to control their badness and do more good things than bad things. At best, we are bad people who have learned, contrary to our natures, to act properly. And then Freud came along, and in the process of attempting to understand his own very odd self, he proposed that bad behavior was the result of bad parenting. He came up with a cockamamie theory to the effect that children's psychological development occurred in 3 stages: oral, anal, and phallic. Don't even ask how such nonsense applies to girls. Almost invariably, parents, more specifically, mothers, responded inappropriately to one or more of these stages. The mother didn't breastfeed long enough, her toilet training methods were punitive, or she caused her boys to feel shame for having penises. And as a result, children became walking basket cases of one sort or another. In Freud's view, the concept of original sin was a primitive attempt at understanding what he alone was smart enough to finally get right. And yes, by all accounts, he was a raging megalomaniac who believed his thoughts were truth. Human beings did not need Christ, or any religious mythology for that matter. Rather, they needed therapy. Thus, psychology became a secular religion, and psychologists became personal saviors. And mothers became beset by anxiety and plagued by guilt. And men stood by, wondering what in the world was going on. Freud's cockamamie theories have produced lots of anxiety and nagging guilt for women, and they have also resulted in mothers being extremely defensive concerning their children. T. Teachers frequently ask me why today's moms have such difficulty accepting that their kids sometimes misbehave. My answer? Because whether they know it or not, they believe Freud. They believe that badness in their kids reflects badly on them. Unlike my mother and other women, B.F., before Freud, they are threatened by reports that their kids have behaved badly. They take these reports personally. When my mom received a report from school that I had misbehaved in class or on the playground, her response was, "Thanks for the report. I will take care of it. Anytime John steps out of line, let me know." She was not surprised or threatened. She did not think bad behavior from John meant she had fallen down on the job. Therefore, she did not respond defensively. Today's all-too-typical mom, upon hearing a report of school misbehavior, becomes her child's advocate and attorney. Her child, she maintains, was unjustly accused, and even if she admits that her child did whatever the teacher is reporting, she insists it is someone else's fault, even the teacher's. The mother's defensiveness is her way of keeping at bay the nagging feeling that if the teacher's report is accurate, then she is to blame. My mother heard a report about me. Today's mom hears a report about herself. I am most definitely not saying that parents are never to blame when it comes to their children's misbehavior. Some parents send completely undisciplined children to school. Most of those parents, when teachers or principals report misbehavior, also become defensive. So we have parents who become defensive for the wrong reason and parents who become defensive for the right reason. What a mess. All of this means that lots of children, a lot of the time, are not being held accountable for their misdeeds. That guarantees that school behavior problems are going to increase, and indeed they have, dramatically so since the days when children had minds of their own. Someone once remarked to me that school behavior was not a problem when teachers were allowed to paddle their students. I disagreed. Paddling had nothing to do with good school behavior. I went to schools where paddles were not used, and yet kids were no less well-behaved than they were at schools I attended where paddling was allowed. It wasn't paddles that made the difference. It was parental support. When children were punished at school, they were punished at home. There was never a question of whether the teacher had reported the problem accurately, and never a question of whether the child, therefore, deserved to be punished. We should all hope for a return to those days. But what if a teacher is wrong about something, John? You might ask. What if she has blamed the wrong child? Well, that presents the child's parents with a golden opportunity to teach the child that life's not fair, I would respond. More on that in the next chapter. Parents are an influence in a child's life and development. They are not the sole influence, and sometimes, through no fault of their own, they are not the biggest influence. For sure, they are the biggest influence when the child is young, but as a child grows, more and more influences, peers, teachers, coaches, random, unpredictable experiences, his or her physical development, to name but a few, leave their mark. But no influence is ever as powerful as the child's own free will. A parent once asked, "When does the child's free will begin asserting itself?" "The reputation 2-year-olds have for being defiant," I answered, "is a symptom of a free will that is already, a mere 2 years into the child's upbringing, a powerful force to be reckoned with. Toddlers most definitely have minds of their own. They hit other children in their preschool program, even though their parents have carefully insulated them from violence of any sort. As soon as they develop speech, they begin to lie, even though their parents have never lied to them. And, interestingly enough, a child's first lie is a variation on the first lie ever told. 'I didn't do it.' Their parents have been nothing but generous with them, yet they will not share with anyone else. Their parents have a demonstrably loving relationship, yet they demonstrate nothing but resentment toward their siblings. The list goes on. Much to their parents' chagrin, at times, children have minds of their own. They are going to do things their way, in their time, at their pace, if they consent to do them at all. The fact that children have minds of their own means they are responsible for their own behavior. If their minds were nothing more than biological computers that their parents and other adults programmed, then personal responsibility would be a fiction. Make no mistake. Parents make mistakes, and some parents make big mistakes that do leave fairly indelible marks on their kids. But when all is said and done, Grandma was right once again. The Bible tells me so. Who did not have a mind of his or her own in the Bible? Why, no one. Adam and Eve surely had minds of their own, as did Cain. The history of mankind is largely the history of the self-destructive means and ends to which God's children have put their own minds. God speaks directly to and inspires certain people, the prophets, for instance, but he does not ever take over someone's brain and turn that person into a mere automaton. Likewise, parents are an influence. They are not the whole story. To ponder and discuss. As a child, did you ever misbehave in ways that had absolutely nothing to do with anything your parents had or had not done, that bore no relation whatsoever to the values they were trying to train into you? If your misbehavior was not a matter of bad parenting, what was it? Have your children ever done weird, strange, odd, bad, and perhaps even downright evil things that cannot possibly be explained in terms of mistakes you have made as a parent? What explains these things?